The economic oppression of the Negro led during 1865 to 1867 to considerable migration. Perhaps as many as 200,000 left the state, and there were attempts to organize unions and strikes for higher wages, particularly in the tobacco factories. In Richmond, there was a stevedore strike and another strike on the Richmond and Danville Railroad. In 1875, a state convention of Negroes assembled, which organized the Laboring Men's Mechanic Union Association to protect Negro labor. The superintendent of public instruction in his report for 1871 said, "The more striking evidences of thrift are, of course, given by comparatively a small proportion of the race, and the general willingness to labor which exists among them is to be partly accounted for by the habit having been formed in slavery. But in the past history of the race in America, there have always been examples of Negro shrewdness and enterprise in every neighborhood. With the very limited opportunities which a slave had for getting money, it is astonishing how many of them bought themselves and their families in order to enjoy freedom, and how common it was for them to gain money for themselves by extra work, by little manufactures, and other honest means. And it is not to be forgotten that during the late war, the Negroes of Richmond contributed thousands of dollars to sustain the Confederacy, and many stood the test of the battlefield on both sides." In 1868, the Negroes of Richmond organized the Virginia Home Building Fund and Loan Association, and in 1875 there was a land and financial association chartered by the legislature to purchase land and small parcels for Negroes. It is estimated that during the late 60s and the early 70s, Virginia Negroes bought between 80,000 and 100,000 acres of land, and there were many individuals who owned considerable quantities. Schools were started at Hampton and Norfolk and were greatly extended by the Freedmen's Bureau. Two political factions now appeared, one consisting of the planters and a few Negroes, and the other of the liberals, Negroes, and Northern and Native whites. Honeycutt became a radical champion. At an Emancipation Day celebration held in Richmond, 1867, Honeycutt spoke. He urged Negroes to register in order to vote in the fall elections. Where they were organized, he said, they should elect a loyal governor and loyal congressman. Negroes were advised not to support white men who had opposed their liberty. Union men also should be tested. Those refusing to sit in a constitutional convention with Negroes should not be supported for office. Negroes who voted for rebels invited the perpetuity of the whipping post, the chain gang, and the vagrant law. Honeycutt regarded with suspicion the praise of Negroes emanating from journals which formerly abused and ridiculed them. He counseled unity of action among the blacks and expressed the hope that whites and Negroes might live together in harmony. A Republican state convention was held April 10, 1867. Some of the Negroes were intelligent-looking men and neatly attired. There were 210 delegates, including 160 Negroes. The Negroes took an active part in the convention. Many wanted land confiscation and distribution, but some opposed it. Fields Cook, a Negro of Richmond, especially warned the Negroes against any ill-advised measures approving confiscation. The resolutions thanked Congress, advocated public schools and universal suffrage, and made special efforts to attract the white laboring class. Honeycutt denied that he had given the Negroes advice detrimental to the whites. He asserted that the Negroes were the bone and sinew of the land, but the pay they received was inadequate. This was an imposition that should not be permitted to continue. He opposed a white-landed aristocracy. He opposed injustice to the Negroes in the courts. Whites, he said, were not executed for murdering, but Negroes were hanged for killing whites. Honeycutt opposed the restitution of the state to native white control. He asserted that Pierpont was a political disloyalist and should not be trusted. He flayed the legislature, stating that its sentiment was attested in the passage of the Vagrant Law, galling alike to poor whites and Negroes. Summoning up his contentions, Honeycutt stated that he did not desire to place Negroes above whites, but he believed that whites and Negroes should be accorded exactly equal rights. The ascendancy of Honeycutt was feared in the North. The New York Tribune spoke against it, and Senator Wilson of Massachusetts was sent to Virginia to counteract him. On the other hand, the planters began to threaten economic proscription against Negroes if they did not work and vote with the native whites. But cooperation was made difficult by Negro agitation for civil rights on streetcars and on juries, which incensed the reactionaries. The freedmen arranged a political meeting at Amelia Courthouse, where prominent whites and Negroes spoke. Consequently, the Republicans became more and more divided. Moderate Republicans tried to organize and leave out the Honeycutt faction. They held a meeting at Charlottesville in July and elected delegates to a convention in Richmond. Meetings for cooperation among blacks and whites were held throughout the state. The Richmond meeting was held in the African Baptist Church and was completely captured by Honeycutt. This defeated cooperation. In the registration, 225,933 persons registered, of whom 120,101 were white and 105,832 were Negroes. The whites had majorities in 52 counties and the Negroes in 50 counties. The election took place October 18, 19, and 20, 1867. The whites cast 76,084 votes, and the Negroes 93,145 votes. The call for a convention was authorized. The planters had 33 delegates, the liberals 72 delegates, and among the latter were 25 Negroes. Honeycutt was arrested for inciting the Negroes to insurrection, but released on bail. The reactionary press boldly advocated proscription of Negro labor and the discharge of workmen who supported the liberal cause. 150 Negroes employed in iron mines were discharged because they voted for the radical ticket. Lewis Lindsay said to this that before any of his children should suffer for food, the streets of Richmond should run knee-deep in blood. And he thanked God that the Negroes had learned to use guns, pistols, and ramrods. Commenting on this, the editor of the Inquirer deplored that the capitalist was threatened with murder if he dared to discharge men who had declared themselves his implacable enemies. He is to house, feed, and cherish the black vipers who meet in midnight conclave, and not content with heaping foul epithets upon him, conspire to defraud him of his property. Undaunted by the presence of the military, the Negroes openly avow sentiments which deserve death upon the gallows. The Pittsburgh Index asserted, "The Negroes are the last men who should complain if their white employers were to discharge them and supply their places with white men." The Lynchburg Virginian said, "They, the native whites, should concert measures without delay to fill the state with white laborers from the North and from Europe. They must crowd the Negro out. They must rid the state of an element that will hinder its prosperity, an element that, under the influence of base white demagogues, themselves without property, would tax the property of others to relieve themselves of obligation to educate their children and care for their paupers." A white man's convention was held in Richmond, November 11th. It appealed to the North not to permit the disgrace of Negro suffrage to be inflicted upon the state, and urged the organization of a party to bring the state under a white man's government. The Constitutional Convention with 105 members met in Richmond, December 3, 1867. There were 35 reactionaries and 65 liberals, and 5 doubtful. Among the liberals were 25 Negroes. The native press ridiculed the convention, calling it the Convention of Kangaroos and the Black Crook Convention. The convention began work in January and first took up a Bill of Rights with a statement of the natural equality of men. When the first section of the preamble was brought up for discussion on January 6, 1868, James W. D. Bland, colored, moved that in place of the word men in the clause, that all men are by nature equally free and independent, as reported from the committee, be substituted the words mankind, irrespective of race or color. Mr. Bland said, "When I recollect that the word men, as written in this first section, has been construed to mean white men only in Virginia, and as the word mankind takes in all the men, women, and children on earth, I propose that as an amendment, as men upon this earth are of different races and colors, and as we are here to propose a Bill of Rights for the people of Virginia, which will make no distinction, I think it right and proper that we should state distinctly what we mean by mankind, or what we mean by men. Mr. Bain, another Negro, replied, I rise to state emphatically that when I was elected to the convention, I pledged the good people of my section that I should endeavor to aid in making a constitution that should not have the word black or white anywhere in it. I told them that I wanted a constitution which our children 15 years hence might read and not see slavery, even as a shadow, remaining in it. I am here to carry out that agreement. All that was necessary in my judgment for this nation to do to abolish slavery was simply to place men in power that would interpret that constitution as an anti-slavery instrument, which I always believed it was. The word slave was not found in it. But bad men in the nation and bad men in power placed such wicked constructions upon it that it worked death to the nation, and that it is the cause of our being here today. The convention discussed free public education and held a long debate on the matter of race separation in schools. The Negroes especially insisted upon mixed schools, and the final report made no specific reference to whether the schools were to be mixed or segregated. When the debates over mixed schools were in progress, Bain proposed an amendment to the committee's plan so as to place blacks and whites in the same schools. The amendment failed to get the support of enough radicals to be adopted, in spite of the efforts on the part of the Negro delegates and the threats of Blaine, Lindsay, Hodges, and others, that if it were not supported by the white radicals, the Negroes would withdraw from the Republican Party. The suffrage was the paramount question. The liberals stood for universal suffrage, while the reactionaries declared that government was the prerogative of white men. Finally, the enfranchisement of all males 21 years of age was adopted. Mr. Bain said, Does the gentleman mean that the black men are not to have any rights in this country? Does he mean to set us free today, and in 50 or 60 years to come, then to give us the right of suffrage? I want it distinctly understood that the old slaveholder's coach moves too slow for us. They design to enslave the blacks again if they can. They design to make him a slave by cutting him off from all opportunities for labor, by starving and oppressing him. Set the Negro free now, and let him remain here. No, that is too much for him. He will enjoy it too much. 100 years to come will be time enough for him to have these rights. In order to carry out their ideas and designs, they have commenced just like they did with secession. They are preaching the danger of a war of races in this hall. They are preaching it in Congress, in the cities and over the country, in the streets and on the seas, on the steamboats, in the cars, in the taverns, and everywhere. This war of races is being preached up constantly, but nobody preaches it up but that side of the House which hates the Republican Party and hates the federal government. Louis Lindsay, a Negro, said, We want to give to the poor classes in this state, blacks and whites, every right to which they are entitled, and we will go home satisfied. I want this black race to have every right that is conferred upon every other man. Mr. Bain said, In one breath he tells the convention that this boon is given to us by the blessed providence of God, and in the next he says that the northern fanatics have clothed us with these rights. If the northern fanatics are the means with which God wishes to confer upon us these rights, I will take the rights, whether they or the devil brought them to us. I know that we have them. There is no power on earth or in hell that can deprive the black man of his right to vote. The economic problems appear in many guises. One resolution was introduced. Resolved, that the Committee on Limitations and Guarantees, when appointed, be entrusted to consider and report the propriety or impropriety of incorporating in the proposed Constitution a provision clothing the General Assembly with power to declare and punish as a misdemeanor the discharge of any person employed as a laborer on account of his political opinions. Mr. Bain said, I claim to be an ignorant man, one not wholly acquainted with this kind of work. I give this convention notice that unless they settle the question mentioned at this time and in the commencement of the sessions, we ignorant men will settle it ourselves and to satisfy ourselves. If we are to be bound and obligated at this time, let us know it. Mr. Mary White asked, why is it that the cry is coming up from the colored men, actually now taking the form of a petition to Congress, that they cannot get employment because the white people hustle them out of it? Mr. Bain answered, will the gentleman allow me to answer his question? The colored people will not work because the employers do not pay them. $6 a month will not pay a man and feed and clothe his wife and children. Former Confederates were disfranchised by a test oath and for participation in the rebellion as officers. The Constitution was adopted by a vote of 51-36, only one Negro voting against it. The reactionary members of the convention joined in a statement. For nearly 5 months, we have patiently sat in this convention listening to the encomiums upon the Negro race, to wholesale denunciations against the whites of the South, to propositions and speeches leveled against property, and addressed to the cupidity of enfranchised slaves, suddenly invested with the controlling power in the state. It was the subject of remark among us during the progress of the convention, said they, that the Negroes grew more and more impracticable. The reported debates of the convention will show how active they gradually became in the proceedings of the body. This Constitution was especially opposed because the test oath went further than congressional legislation. It also provided for the reorganization of counties, which interfered with the rule of certain families who had dominated various county governments. Income taxes were imposed on incomes over $600, a poll tax on all males, and a homestead exemption. Civil and political rights were guaranteed, and a system of free public schools. Voting on this Constitution was postponed by the military commander General J.M. Schofield, who was hostile to it, and refused to let money for the election be taken from the state treasury. The election, therefore, could not be held unless Congress made a special appropriation. Political parties, nevertheless, began to prepare for the election, and the Republicans nominated H.H. Wells over Honeycutt. The Conservative Party condemned the abominable Constitution and nominated Withers, a Confederate colonel. Withers pledged himself to fight against Negro suffrage and said, I appear before you as the standard-bearer of the white man's party. I do not ask the support of the Negroes, nor do I expect it, for I consider them unfit to exercise the right of suffrage. In the meantime, the Republicans appealed to Congress, and the House of Representatives passed a bill to hold the election in August 1868, and then afterward another bill to hold it in May 1869. But the Senate would not assent. Meantime, more moderate men in Virginia proposed that Negro suffrage be accepted, but that the new Constitution be rejected. This led to a convention in December in Richmond, which stated that while it did not believe in Negro suffrage, it would accept it. A committee went to Washington, and also a Republican Party committee was sent. They appeared before the Committee of 15. Finally, the Republicans held a new convention, again nominating Wells, but with him as Lieutenant Governor, a Negro, Dr. J.D. Harris. This convention split, and the seceders nominated a white man, Walker, for governor. President Grant ordered an election to be held July 6, 1869, with a separate vote as to the test oath and disfranchisement of Confederates. The reactionaries supported Walker, and the ensuing campaign turned entirely on the Negro. Walker was elected, the whites casting 125,114 votes, and the Negroes 97,201 votes. Harris was defeated by a vote of 99,600 to 120,068 for his white opponent. The disfranchisement and test oath clauses were rejected, but the Constitution was ratified. Among the white people, there was great rejoicing over the result. The Petersburg Index said, "Virginia has accepted restoration, has rebuked proscription, has vindicated her right to a voice in the control of her affairs, and by a vote unprecedentedly large, places at the head of the government the ticket of peace and equality." The Danville Register said, "Let us all now go to work, white and colored, looking forward hopefully to a just and liberal system of legislation and an impartial administration for the protection of all alike." The Lynchburg Virginian said, "The deluded Negroes have been taught a lesson, which will bring them to their senses, and we shall have no more trouble with them." The Norfolk Journal rejoiced that Virginia was redeemed, regenerated, and disenthralled. The colored conservative Republican group sought to encourage the depressed Negroes and appealed to the whites not to take economic revenge upon the Negroes and drive them away from their jobs because they had voted in accordance with their convictions. October 5th, the General Assembly came together and ratified the 14th Amendment, but the liberal Republicans continued dissatisfied and declared that the election held in July resulted in a Confederate triumph and was achieved by artifice, intimidation, and fraud. They tried to keep the federal government from admitting the state, but Grant recommended its admission, and Virginia was restored February 8, 1870. The new Constitution was, on the whole, an excellent instrument. Taylor says that it gave Virginia the only democratic instrument of government it has ever had. In spite of some of its cumbrous provisions and its imperfect machinery, the Underwood Constitution was as far ahead of that of the old regime or that of the present Virginia caste system as a modern steamship is of an Indian canoe. Such an innovation, of course, struck the reactionaries as a disaster, destructive of all that the gods had ordained as equitable and just. An Englishman in 1870 said of the legislature, "I counted among the delegates," he said, "three or four colored men, one of whom was a pure Negro, very well attired, and displaying not more jewelry than a gentleman might wear, while another, who seemed to have some white blood in his veins, was a quite masculine-looking person, both physically and mentally." The Senate was presided over by the Lieutenant Governor of the state, who was altogether like a young member of the British House of Lords, as the Senate itself had a country gentleman sort of air, not perceptible in the lower house, which more resembled a town council or parochial board than the House of Commons. There were two colored senators among the number, quite black, but senatorial enough, and like men who in Africa would probably have been chiefs. In the lower house, the colored delegates mingled freely with the other members, but in the Senate, these two sat in a corner by themselves. Here, then, was a state in which the Negroes never had control, and nevertheless, its chief difficulty under white control was the progressive piling up of an enormous debt, which in January 1872 amounted to $43,690,542. Nothing illustrates better than this the fact that there was no necessary connection between debt and Negro control. The subsequent history of Virginia for many years was the question of paying or repudiating this debt. Meantime, gradually, the Negroes were disfranchised by continued economic pressure, by appeals from their white friends and connections, and by force and fraud. Arkansas had 12,597 whites and only 1,676 Negroes in 1820. In 1860, it had 324,143 whites and 111,259 Negroes. There was a brief military rule in Arkansas under John S. Phelps in 1862, followed by a year of civil war in 1863. Then came 4 years of civil state government under Governor Murphy, 1864 to 1867. In 1867, the civil government was subordinated to a military regime under Brigadier Generals of the United States Army. Then came the Republican government under Powell Clayton, 1868 to 1871, and 4 additional years of Republican rule, after which came the Revolution, in which the Republicans were driven from power by the local Democrats, assisted by Republican influences at Washington. At the outbreak of the Civil War, the Negroes resided mainly in the lowlands, where most of the plantations were located. During the war, the slaves remained with their masters until the federal military operations of 1863 took place in sections containing the largest numbers of Negroes. All territory along the White River from Pea Ridge to Helena and westward to Little Rock came under federal control, and the southeastern counties and lower Arkansas also were captured. The Negroes in these sections then began to enter the federal lines in large numbers. A group of Union sympathizers determined to reorganize the state and sought Lincoln's cooperation. He cautiously gave it under his military power, but the group went ahead boldly, held a convention in January 1864, adopted a constitution, and elected Isaac Murphy governor. 2 senators were sent to Washington, but Congress called a halt on this summary action and would not admit them. In 1866, the returned Confederates practically took charge of the Murphy government and sent a commission to Washington to confer concerning the condition of the state. The most important change in the Constitution during this time was the abolition of slavery and the prohibition of indenture of any Negro except as an apprentice. Some of the leaders preferred permanent despotism to restoration under Negro suffrage. General Albert Pike said Negro suffrage would make a hell on earth, a hideous, horrid pandemonium filled with all the devils of vice, crime, pauperism, corruption, violence, political debauchery, social anarchy. Meantime, congressional reconstruction was begun. Registration began in May 1867, but progressed slowly. A few whites told the Negroes registration was for the purpose of enrolling them for taxes, but the Freedmen's Bureau sent out agents to instruct them in the purpose of voting. A number of registered voters in Arkansas was 66,805. 41,134 voted at the election, and of these, 27,756 voted for and 13,558 against, holding a constitutional convention. Upon these figures, General Ord announced the names of delegates elected to the convention. The Arkansas Constitutional Convention convened January 7, 1868, in the city of Little Rock, and adjourned February 14, 1868. There were 8 Negro delegates to the convention: J.W. Mason, Richard Samuels, William Murphy, Monroe Hawkins, William Gray, James T. White, Henry Rector, and Thomas P. Johnson. Hempstead County had 1 Negro out of 4 delegates, Jefferson, 1 out of 4, Lafayette, 1 out of 2. Phillips and Pulaski each had 2 out of 4. Of the Negro delegates, 1 was a postmaster, 2 were farmers, 4 ministers, and 1 a planter. Seibert, leader of the white conservatives, proposed in the convention of 1868 the adoption of the Constitution of 1864. Seibert claimed to be a friend of the Negro. He had been a Freedmen's Bureau agent for a while and had always been desirous of advancing the interests of this unfortunate race. He knew the Negro in all his attributes, that their people were now being misled. He appealed to the Negro members present. Mr. Brooks, white, interrupted, to rise to a point of order. It was disrespectful to style the gentlemen of the convention Negroes. Mr. Gray, colored, of Phillips County, said he took no objection to the appellation. His race was closely allied to the race which built the great pyramids of Egypt, where slept the remains of those whose learning had taught Solon and Lycurgus to frame the systems of their laws, and to whom the present ages are indebted for the hints of art and knowledge. Mr. Seipert, White, said he was glad that the rebellion had been crushed. He was glad the Negro was free, but while he would have the Negroes protected, as they now are by law, in all their just rights, he could never consent to see them entrusted with the elective franchise and made the rulers of white men. Mr. Gray of Phillips replied, "I must confess my surprise at the action of the gentleman from White County, Mr. Seipert. I am here as the representative of a portion of the citizens of Arkansas whose rights are not secured by the ordinance offered by the gentleman from White. Men, sir, who have stood by the government and the old flag in times of trouble, when the Republic trembled with the thought of civil war from center to circumference, from base to cop. From this and other considerations, we are here not to ask charity at the hands of this honorable body, but to receive at the hands of the people of Arkansas, in convention assembled, the apportionment of our rights, as assigned by the Reconstruction Acts of Congress. I am here, sir, to see those rights of citizenship engrafted upon the organic law of this state. The gentleman from White does not seem to recognize the fact that the present Constitution is not in accordance with the Constitution of the United States, guaranteeing to each state a republican form of government. The gentleman from White says the Negro cannot become a citizen. The fact is patent that we have exercised the rights of citizenship under the Constitution in all the states except South Carolina, and that we voted for that time-honored instrument, the Federal Constitution, by voting for the men that ratified it. Before the Revolution, all native-born free persons were British subjects, and hence citizens, as the British government did not base allegiance or citizenship on color or complexion. Hence we passed from British subjects to American subjects without changing our relative status as to citizenship. This, I think, disposes of the assertion that we cannot be citizens under the Constitution. But, sir, I claim that it is ours, not only on constitutional grounds, according to the rulings of distinguished American jurists, but ours by right of purchase on the numerous battlefields of our country. It is ours, because from the Revolution down to and through the Rebellion, we have stood unswervingly by our country and the flag. We fought for liberty. That liberty cannot be secured to us without the right of suffrage. The government owes the debt, acknowledges it, and apportions it out among the several states. We are here, sir, to receive the amount due us from the state of Arkansas. The troubles now on the country are the result of the bad exercise of the elective franchise by unintelligent whites, the poor whites of the South. I could duplicate every Negro who cannot read and write, whose name is on the list of registered voters, with a white man equally as ignorant. James T. White, a colored man, spoke on social equality. I cannot think that the extension of the right of suffrage to colored men could be construed as opening the parlors of white people to a forcible entrance of colored men, but on the contrary, their virtue and pride of race will be a sufficient safeguard to prevent them from anything like social intercourse. Who is to blame for the present state of affairs? When I look around, I see an innumerable company of mulattoes, not one of them the heir of a white woman. This is satisfactory evidence of the virtue of white women. In the late bloody war, these gentlemen left their wives and daughters in the care of colored men for 4 years. And I defy the gentlemen to cite me a single instance where they have failed to live up to their integrity. Gentlemen, the shoe pinches on the other foot. The white men of the South have been for years indulging in illicit intercourse with colored women. And in the dark days of slavery, this intercourse was largely forced upon the innocent victims, and I think the time has come when such a course should end. Mr. William Murphy, a colored man, said February 10th, when the late war resulted in the issuing of the Emancipation Proclamation by Abraham Lincoln, 4 millions of our enslaved brethren were called to aid in the establishment of this union of loyalty. For the colored troops have proved their loyalty. They protected the Union flag. So they stood. And white gentlemen have been compelled to surrender the sword. At the same time, they will rise here, under the same flag, after they have dropped their swords and their bayonets and seek to limit our privileges. I would never have spoken but to say this to the men that have been our masters, men whom we have brought to the very condition they are now in, and have not only fed them, but have clothed them, have tied their shoes, and finally have fought until they are obliged to surrender. Yet now that they have surrendered, they say we have no rights. Has not the man who has conquered upon the battlefield gained any rights? Have we gained none by the sacrifice of our brethren? Concerning the adoption of the Constitution, James P. Johnson, a colored man, said, I believe this Constitution to be the best one that Arkansas ever had. The gentleman from Ashley, Mr. Moore, has undertaken to show us that the class of men of whom he is a representative are our best friends. My God! I hope he will put his hand over his mouth and never speak that word again. We are very much inclined to believe the men who are trying to secure equal rights of voting according to the true Republican doctrine of the equal rights of all men. You do not want us to have any rights, but just let us stay in slavery as we were before the war. James Mason, another colored delegate, read the following explanation of his vote, which he asked to have spread upon the journal. I object to the continued disfranchisement of all persons who are now disfranchised by the present Reconstruction Acts of Congress, and I believe many are now disfranchised who ought not be. But in the face of the reiterated assertions of gentlemen of the Conservative Party that they are not to give us the right of suffrage under any circumstances, I am forced to accept this Constitution as being good as a whole, and as being the best that I can get under the circumstances, and give up my ideas of limited disfranchisement and qualified suffrage. James White, the colored delegate, added, Another reason why I shall vote, and why, if I had 10,000 votes, I would give them all for the Constitution, is that I see in it a principle that is intended to elevate our families, the principle of schools, of education. That is the only way that these Southern people can be elevated. Were they properly educated, they would not be led from any prejudice to oppress other men. Were they educated, they would not hate us, because we have been slaves. But like these, gentlemen, if they should puzzle their brains and risk their lives upon the battlefield for the Union, they would stand up for our rights. Away with Union men who will not give all men their rights. Talk about friendship. The devil has such friends locked up, and hell is full of them. In the course of convention sessions, a conservative taunted a carpetbagger with the assertion that the Negro vote was his only way to ride into Congress. Thereupon, Negro members said their race was ready both to vote and fight for the whites who would grant them political rights. Brooks, leader of the Radicals, declared, We, the great Republican Party, hold that they, the Negro, should have the ballot, and we intend that they should have it, and we will sustain the government based upon the principles of universal franchise and universal equality. On the other hand, Hinkle, a scalawag, exclaimed, "Great God! Is there no help for the widow's son?" and asserted that all the devils in hell could not keep him from making himself a record by voting against adoption of the Constitution. Despite this, the final vote was 45-21 in favor of adoption. On April 1st, it was announced that the Constitution had been ratified by a vote of 30,380-41. On May 7th, a bill for the readmission of Arkansas was presented in Congress by Thaddeus Stevens. It was finally passed in both houses and over the president's veto on June 22, 1868. Before the bill was presented to Congress, however, the state legislature had met April 2, 1868, and adopted the 14th Amendment, which was one of the prerequisites to her admission. The Constitution of Arkansas, like that of Florida, was a document which centralized power in the state government. The governor appointed nearly all the local officers in counties and townships, and he had the power to fill vacancies, even in the few offices he did not originally fill. He appointed judges, collectors, and assessors of taxes, justices of the peace, prosecuting attorneys, registrars of elections, who in turn appointed the judges of elections. In April 1867, a union convention at Little Rock nominated a state ticket and succeeded in electing Powell Clayton as governor. One Negro, John Payton of Pulaski County, was on the Committee of Resolutions. Otherwise, the Negro was not represented among the officials in this party convention. During 1868 through 1873, Clayton ruled Arkansas with an iron hand, while the Ku Klux Klan practically carried on civil war. In 1869, an anti-Ku Klux Klan law of great severity was passed, which prevented all secret political organizations and declared their members public enemies. Even the possession of a Ku Klux Klan costume was a criminal offense. The law was sternly enforced, and the Klan disbanded after a season of martial law. In February 1873, a severe civil rights law was passed, which compelled hotels and places of public amusement to admit colored people and ensured them equal school facilities in separate schools. Fines of $200 to $1,000 or imprisonment of 3 to 12 months were provided. Officers of the law may be prosecuted for failure to enforce it, and prosecuting attorneys, sheriffs, coroners, justices of the peace, and even constables are to institute proceedings and are obliged to do so. Many of these officers throughout the state are colored men. I was told there had been but a single case under this act in which a saloon keeper was fined $25. I noticed that some drinking saloons had two bars, one for each color. But I also saw in several cases black and white men drinking together. The Negroes have shown no disposition to make the law offensive. The rulers of the state constituted a closed ring, which had no Negro members, but its power depended on controlling the Negro vote and on the disfranchisement of about 20,000 of the former Confederates. Those disfranchised were given the right to vote by a constitutional amendment in 1872. In April 1874, a civil war broke out in Arkansas between Baxter, the regular Republican, and Brooks, a reform Republican. Each claimed to be governor. Baxter was recognized by the legislature, but Brooks took possession of the state buildings by force. They appealed to President Grant. Grant refused to take part, but the federal forces prevented the two parties from fighting. Grant finally recognized Baxter as governor because the legislature had, and ordered the Brooks forces to disperse. A constitutional convention was held, which cut down the length of the governor's term and his power. Brooks now allied himself with the Democrats and declared that the constitutional convention had not been called according to law and was the result of conspiracy. The Democratic convention nominated Garland. The Republican convention, not recognizing the election as lawful, made no nominations. Garland was therefore elected. Grant came to the conclusion that the Constitutional Convention was illegal and that Brooks was still governor. but Congress declared against federal interference. Finally, in 1874, the Democrats secured complete control of the state. Arkansas, thus, was a contrast to Louisiana. Law and order conquered, but it conquered not for the purpose of giving the Negro any economic power, or, in fact, anything at all, except schools and the Civil Rights Bill. The government dictatorship was frankly capitalistic, and for the benefit of capital and the protagonists who represented it. Texas had in 1860 182,921 Negroes and 420,891 whites, thus putting this state among those where the Negro population was a decided minority and white immigration destined greatly to increase the preponderance of the whites. The division of the planters and poor whites was less distinct in this state than in many others. There was plenty of rich land, and the poorest white men could get a start. This increased the demand for labor. Texas was one of the southern states that had considerable prosperity during the war. She was outside the area of conflict. Excellent crops were raised, and slave labor was plentiful. Many slaves were deported to Texas for protection, especially from Louisiana and Arkansas, so that Texas could furnish food and raw material for the Confederate states. And on the other hand, when the blockade was strengthened, Texas became the highway for sending cotton and other goods to Europe by way of Mexico. There were many losses because of the distance, the dishonesty of traders, and lawlessness. Nevertheless, these were offset by the high prices. When the war neared its end, the Confederate troops in Texas got out of hand and began rebelling and looting. Towns like Houston were burned, and clothes and food and all sorts of goods stolen. The Texas Republican stressed the ruinous effect of freeing 4 million of ignorant and helpless blacks, and said that the people of the North would be glad to witness a return of slavery because it would raise larger crops and a richer market for Yankee manufacturers. This paper did not think that slavery would be abolished for at least 10 years, and that in the meantime compulsory labor would continue. Under the army officials, the compulsory labor did continue, but when the officials of the Freedmen's Bureau arrived, they began to supervise contracts. There was the usual complaint that Negroes were not keeping their contracts, together with reports that they were working well. President Johnson appointed A.J. Hamilton as provisional governor. He was a native of Alabama, but had come to Texas before the war. He had refused to join the seceding states and fled to Louisiana, where he became a brigadier general in the federal army. When he arrived in Texas, he found everything in confusion. Money had been stolen from the treasury, the Capitol building was without a roof, and there was general anarchy. Hamilton protested to Johnson against the tendency of the farmers to keep the Negroes as slaves. The question of the legal status of the Negroes, the governor left to the courts, and the courts contradicted themselves in their decisions, some of them admitting Negro testimony and others refusing it altogether. There continued the strong feeling that either the Negroes were going to remain in bondage or compensation was going to be paid for their emancipation. The lawlessness continued. Robbery and murder of Unionists and freedmen were common, and outlaws defied arrest. One county reports that the civil authorities are helpless because the country is full of ruffians and lawless men. Another that the laws cannot be enforced without the aid of the military. The Inspector General on the staff of General Howard declared early in 1866 that Texas was in the worst condition of any state that he had visited, that almost the whole population was hostile in feeling and action to the United States, that there was a mere semblance of government, and that the whites and the Negroes were everywhere ignorant, lawless, and starving. The Assistant Commissioner for Texas under the Freedmen's Bureau arrived in Texas in September 1865 and began to appoint local agents in December. He found the freedmen not only willing but anxious to improve every opportunity offered for their moral and intellectual advancement. In January 1866, one Black Belt county reports that 2/3 of the freed population were then at work at good wages, and that 7,000 contracts had been filed already, and that unemployed freedmen were becoming scarce. By the end of January, there were 26 day and night schools, and 1,600 Negro pupils enrolled. There was the usual bitter attack upon the presence of Negro troops late in 1865 and early in 1866. After much delay, an election was held January 8, 1866, and a convention was scheduled to meet in Austin in February. There were strong differences of opinion among the delegates. Dalrymple said, "My opponents, each and all, concede something to the Negroes, some more, some less, approximating to equality with the white race. I concede them nothing but the station of hewers of wood and drawers of water. If a Republican form of government is to be sustained, the white race must do it without any Negro alloy. A mongrel Mexico affords no fit example for imitation. I desire the perpetuation of a white man's government." Colonel M.T. Johnson of Tarrant County declared his opposition to granting the Negro any political rights whatever, and insisted that he should be made to work by uniform laws regulating pauperism, labor, and apprenticeship, but at the same time asserted the necessity of treating him with justice and kindness in his helpless condition. There seems to have been only one candidate, E. Degener, a prominent German of San Antonio who openly advocated Negro suffrage. One prominent Texan, John H. Reagan, a prisoner of war at Fort Warren, Massachusetts, wrote a thoughtful letter in August, which was published in Texas in October. He pointed out that the South was in the position of a conquered nation, that Texas would not be restored until it did what the North demanded, and that the North demanded protection against secession, the abolition of slavery, and civil rights for the freedmen. Moreover, it was probable that this alone would not satisfy the North and that it would demand Negro suffrage. Reagan, therefore, advised that Negro testimony be admitted in courts and that an intelligence and possibly a property test be set for admission to the right to vote, regardless of race or color, provided that no persons previously entitled to vote should be deprived of the right by the new requirements. President Johnson secured a parole for Reagan, and it was hoped that he would have influence on the state, but his wise advice raised such opposition that he long refrained from further discussion. A refusal to accede to these conditions would only result in a prolongation of the time during which you will be deprived of the civil government of your own choice and will continue subject to military rule. When the convention assembled, the former secessionists were in control. The governor in his message stressed the necessity of giving full civil rights to the Negro and the possibility of political suffrage. He said, "I do not believe that the great mass of the freedmen in our midst are qualified by their intelligence to exercise the right of suffrage, and I do not desire to see this privilege conferred upon them. But if we fail to make political privileges depend upon rules of universal application, we will inevitably be betrayed into legislation under the influence of ancient prejudices and with a view only to the present. I think that human wisdom cannot discern what is to be the future of the African race in this country. I would not be willing to deprive any man who is qualified under existing laws to vote of the exercise of that privilege in the future. But I believe it would be wise to relegate the qualifications of those who are to become voters hereafter by rules of universal application." The convention dawdled and spent most of its time electioneering for the senatorships and entered into a metaphysical discussion as to whether secession was illegal from the beginning or should simply be disavowed at present. Finally, the usual Southern circumlocutions were adopted. African slavery had been terminated by the United States government, and therefore it should be discontinued in Texas. Negroes were to have property rights, but could testify only in cases involving Negroes, although the legislature could, when it wished, give them full rights of testimony. The German Degener was alone in his advocacy of Negro suffrage. There was some debate on repudiating the civil debt, which had been recklessly increased to nearly $8,500,000. After a session of 8 weeks, the convention adjourned, having failed to take any really advanced step except the grudging recognition of emancipation. Immediately, preparations were made for the coming elections, and a considerable party wanted to drive out all Union men and nullify the emancipation of Negroes. The planters supported the president of the convention as governor and opposed Negro suffrage. Their ticket was elected by a large majority and eventually recognized by the president. Former Confederates, elected as senators, were unable to take the test oath. They and the representatives were refused seats in Congress. The 13th and 14th Amendments were presented to the legislature, the first without comment and the second with unqualified disapproval. The 14th Amendment was rejected by a vote of 70-5 in the House and a large majority in the Senate. Reagan again called attention to the trend of events and advocated qualified Negro suffrage and the right of Negroes to testify in the courts. His letter produced only irritation. The new head of the Freedmen's Bureau, General Kiddo, favored the employers as against the Negro laborers and established heavy fines for enticing laborers away from employers. A black code gave certain rights to freedmen not prohibited by the Constitution, but forbade intermarriage, voting, holding public office, serving on juries, or testifying in cases where Negroes were not concerned. Johnson urged that civil rights be extended to the colored people if it had not already been done. Violence continued in the spring and summer of 1866. The town of Brenham was burned. Soldiers broke up a Negro ball, and there was general lawlessness. Gangs of horse thieves and desperados were roaming about. Federal officials reported that Union men and Negroes were fleeing for their lives, and that murders and outrages on Negroes were on the increase, while criminals were always acquitted. Kiddo substituted yearly contracts instead of monthly contracts in the cotton districts and tried to assure the freedmen of their wages. He repudiated the labor law passed by the legislature, but his successor adopted some of its provisions. March 19, 1867, Sheridan was made commander of the 5th Military District, consisting of Louisiana and Texas. Unable to secure the release of large numbers of Negroes imprisoned on trivial charges, Sheridan issued his jury order, excluding from juries persons who were unable to take the test oath. Sheridan declared that one trial of a white man for killing a Negro was a farce. Meantime, the registration of voters under the new congressional legislation began. The Negroes were eager to vote. A new state Republican Party was organized, and there was advocacy of free common schools and free homesteads from the public lands to all without discrimination of color. E.M. Peace was appointed governor by Sheridan July 30, 1867, and Throckmorton removed. Peace was a native of Connecticut, but had been in Texas since 1835, and during 1853 through 1857 had been governor of the state. He opposed secession. There arose among the Republicans a severe difference of opinion as to how far the former Confederates should be disfranchised. The president in August removed Sheridan from command and substituted Thomas. 10 days later, he substituted Hancock for Thomas. Hancock assumed command in November. He was a Democrat and a follower of Johnson. He reversed Sheridan's order concerning juries and declared that the country was in a state of profound peace. Peace flatly contradicted this and said there had been 100 murders during the past year, with only 10 arrests and 5 trials. He declared that because of Hancock's order concerning juries, there had been an increase in crime and hostility to the government. Agitation arose because it was said that Negroes were carrying arms, although it was well known that every white Texan was habitually armed. A Negro meeting which was addressed by a Supreme Court judge was broken up, and the judge complained, "None but a Johnson man could be tolerated here. He must cuss Congress and damn the nigger. General Hancock is with the president politically and will only execute the letter of the law to escape accountability. There is not an intelligent rebel in all the land who does not understand him." During 1867, there was bad feeling between the races. The whites especially resented arms in the hands of the Negro soldiers, and the impossibility of convicting white aggressors upon black men was continually manifest. A judge declared that it was impossible to convict a white man of any crime on Negro testimony. where the crime was against a Negro, to convict a white man of murder in the first degree was out of question. Registration of voters had begun early in the summer of 1867, but went on slowly. The conservatives first proposed not to register, and then afterward changed their minds and registered with the plan of staying away from the election. The election was held in February 1868 and showed that comparatively few whites had been disfranchised. 59,633, or 14% of the white population, registered in 1867, and 49,497 Negroes, or 27% of the colored population. A majority of the whites voted against the convention, but the blacks carried it. The total registration was 109,130, and the white registration was about equal to the total vote in the campaign of 1866. The election was quiet, and the convention won by an overwhelming vote of 44,689 to 11,440. In the Constitutional Convention, it was characteristic that among the 90 members there were 12 reactionary white members from the Black Belt, elected undoubtedly by all too common methods. There were 9 Negroes and delegates from the black districts bordering on the Brazos and Trinity Rivers. J.T. Ruby came from Galveston. He was an educated Negro and was elected from the white district of Galveston. Ruby was a mulatto from Philadelphia and for 15 years was the leader of the Negroes. He was rated as an astute politician and a man of unusual ability. He was very popular in Galveston, where his brother held a position in the custom house.